So let me welcome all of you who've joined so far. My name is Chico Ferreira, and I'll be chairing the seminar today with Frank Cowell. Just before I say a word or two about Frank, though, next week we have The Violence of Uncertainty: How Asylum Waiting Time Undermines Refugees' Health. So that'll be on Tuesday the 24th at 1 p.m. instead of 12:30. And that's part of the Migration, Ethnicity, and Race seminar. The speaker is Sin Yi Chung from Cardiff University. And of course, if you like more information about upcoming events at the III, you can sign up to our newsletter. Now, it's a great pleasure for me to welcome Frank Cowell today. Frank is a world-renowned expert on income distribution and inequality. He's a professor of economics at LSE, the Department of Economics. He's also the director of the Distributional Analysis Research Program at Stickard. He's been hugely influential in this field, not least as also an editor. He's an associate editor of the Journal of Public Economics. He was the editor of Economica here at the LSE for a long time, and he's currently the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Economic Inequality. Among his minor achievements, he also helped me a great deal get through my PhD as my supervisor, but he's not to blame for the outcome. and today he's going to be talking about a really fascinating paper, Found in Translation, Language Legislation and Prosocial Preferences. Frank, thanks very much for joining us. Over to you.
Well, thanks. And I should say that today I'm completely out of my depth because when Chico kindly invited me to give a seminar in this series, I gave, I think, three or four titles of sort of current work. Three of them were pretty much complete and, if I may borrow a phrase, oven ready. And there's the fourth, which I said is really work in progress, and it's this one. And Chico said, this is the one we want. So I said, well, it is work in progress. They said, well, okay, fine. Now, as you see from the opening the title page here, it's three of us who are at it. Juan, I think you probably know in the International Inequalities Institute from presentation he's done before. He's at LSE in health policy. And Shania Palocha is a PhD student in the economics department. And the background here is that Shania and I knew each other from the two-year MSc program where she was before, and then when she graduated, she was talking to me about the work that I'd done with Juan and was largely instrumental in saying, well, how about India? And so I thought, well, how about India? And so it led to something which eventually came to this. I should also mention, would like to acknowledge the great help we've had from Shivani Pandey, who may be joining us from New Delhi, and also Visheshika Bahetti, whose work, she couldn't join us today, but you'll see from the slides where her influence has had. So here's the rough approach that we want to adopt today. First of all, I'd like to talk a little bit about identity and preferences with mainly a nod towards the economics of identity. Then, coming on to the more precise subject material, a bit about languages in India and why they're relevant to what we're talking about here. Obviously, introducing the data and the particular variables we've got from the data, and then looking at the model and results that we're going to talk about today. It is a work in progress, as I say, so at the end, we'll discuss a little bit of recent developments and where we're going. Oops, that's the wrong one. Let's go back. It's one of these sort of dynamic screens. We need to move on to this. There we go. Okay. So if we were thinking about identity and, social preferences, we're really focusing on this kind of question, what underlies the taste of redistribution, if you like, or preference for redistribution, pro-social preferences. We think of the notion of identity So where do I belong, to whom do I belong, to what do I belong, and how does this affect my preferences, and how does it affect my actions? Not focusing so much on actions here, but on preferences. You know, there could be a variety of personal circumstances. It could be down to the structure of society that we're looking at. Now, in the broad literature there is on preferences for redistribution, you've got a whole bunch of political economy stuff, going from the Meltzer and Richard seminal article onwards. My co-author, Joanne, is very skeptical of this for reasons I don't need to go into now. And you've got other explanations for preferences for redistribution. People may have biased perceptions of what the situation is, what redistribution can achieve. There may be expectations of social mobility. There's a whole literature largely across the Atlantic of seeing social mobility as a positive alternative to redistribution. There are ethnic reasons for motivating preferences for redistribution and so on. Now, when we're talking about social identity, we're thinking about particular reference points that people may have or social norms. And it may be particularly important in the context of a specific nation or regions of a nation. We'll see that's kind of important in the case of India. So, what about the mechanisms that are at work, so to speak, behind the scenes of what we're looking at, you know, before we get to the detail of India? So, with an economics background, as Chico introduced me, you could think of identity as a kind of club good. You know, belong to a particular club, and then this club good is a bit like a public good, but not quite. This enters into individuals' utility function, and it's going to affect behavior. So a bit further down the line, if you don't act along with the group, you experience what we would call this utility. It can give rise to rather peculiar biases. And there's an interesting recent literature which shows how people who happen to live in rich locations really don't see the situation as reality would portray it. Of course, the actual preferences for redistribution are subject to bias. Interesting paper by someone else that Chico knows well, Guillermo Cruces and co, produced this fascinating paper on, again, whether biases are affected by where you are in the distribution. So the identity literature tells us that, you know, we can connect this concept of identity to such things as political attitudes, tolerance, democracy. We're seeing rather interesting work in progress, it seems to me, in the United States right now about this. And no doubt there are PhD theses aplenty that's going to use as the data that have arisen from recent history there. One quite interesting thing is that sometimes the concept of identity means that within a nation, you know, you can cut across borders, you can cut across racial divisions, and this appears to be one of the things that's at work in India. So let's move on to India itself. Now, when I was talking to people some time ago about starting work on India, I was saying, well, you know, I was contrasting work I'd done before with to do with economic mobility or income mobility in China, and, you know, work with Chinese colleagues contrasting China and India. And I said, well, you know, it's interesting because if you compare China and India, China, huge population, billion plus, Huge country, one time zone, one language. India, population, billion plus, huge country, one time zone, and 1,001 languages, which wasn't really fair on either China or India, because there is a bit of linguistic diversity in China, but not that much. Mandarin pretty much everywhere. It was also unfair to India because I sort of underestimated. Not 1,001 languages, but according to a not so distant census in India, huge number of languages, what was regarded as the mother tongue, even if you edit it down a bit and get the sort of official number of languages, it's still pretty much an underestimate. So we're talking about a large number of things that people would regard as their mother tongue. And it shapes life rather markedly in India. So here's an interesting point, which I must admit I wasn't fully aware of until getting involved in this project, so that it's quite normal, multilingualism. So, you know, one language at home, one language with your friends, one language for education, this kind of thing. And indeed, the education system follows this three-language formula. So where you are, English is a fairly normal thing within education in India. And there's education in Hindi, particularly, I mean, in non-Hindi states or some other Indian language. We'll come on to just mention Hindi a little bit more in a moment, because there is this great divide in India. So you take the map of India and you sort of divide the pointy bit that's sticking down north and south, and it is a remarkable language divide which feeds through into all sorts of things. So north of the line, you've got these sort of Indo-European groups, so that you find that, well, for example, with a language like Hindi, it has a grammatical structure that's, if you happen to come from a background where you understand German or Russian and so on, you know, you can see, oh, right, I understand how the Hindi grammar works. And many other North Indian languages follow along that general sort of pattern. South Indian languages, completely different. There is, you know, it's the Dravidian languages are one of the, I forget how many major language groups that are identified in the world, but we're talking about sort of four or five broad language groups. So it is a huge chasm linguistically between North and South. And indeed, southern India has been the seat of protest. It's been the seat of general unhappiness politically with issues that are partly driven by language and partly by other grievances. Interestingly, I didn't realize this until fairly recently, these issues over language and the protests over language preceded the independence of India. Well, let's move on. How have languages worked out officially within India? So pretty much straight after the formation of the Indian state, it was quite an interesting development, really. So we'll recognize this possibility for, what's the word there, this sort of sub-nations. You know, we don't, you know, here we are with our brand new state. We don't want the language diversity to create fractionalization, bearing in mind all the mess that happened, for example, at partition. So progressing on through, you've got the issue of linguistic states became prominent. Pretty much straight off, you've got protests again within southern India, Should we have a separate state? You've got in the 50s various political developments which linked state reorganization to language. And it's kind of interesting, it was never an explicit rejection of the 1948 Commission, it just sort of faded away a bit. And so that in the mid-50s, you'd got states specifically being organized on a linguistic basis. So, some obviously, you've got this, I can't even remember what 1001 languages. You haven't got 1001 states. So there is, sorry, it was, oh, maybe it's just a gremlin on the line there. So you've got concepts of official languages within India. So the original plan was to phase out English. Well, that didn't happen. So that now both Hindi and English are official languages. Why did this come out? Well, the reasons are complex, but again, it's the result of widespread protests against Hindi. Okay, why the protest? Well, it's like a symbol of northern dominance. Well, we're not going to